Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and I'm joined here in the studio by Sound Effect producers Kevin Kniestad.
Hello.
And Allie Ferguson.
Hey there.
Because today's theme is staff favorites. And this year, we produced more than 160 stories. We went from the Olympic Peninsula to Soap Lake.
Three times.
And we looked back at all of these stories and selected three of our favorites to share with you today. But before we get to that, let's listen back to some of the many voices we heard in 2016 on Sound Effect.
As far as tumor cells go, these are big and ugly and nasty looking.
I don't know, I felt kind of trapped by like the Obamacare kid thing, and I sort of let that take over.
And he had slip-on sandals, and I could see that he had six toes on each foot.
More than anything in life, I wanted to be friends with that whale.
When the lava lamp's built, it'll be the beginning of a new renaissance for Soap Lake.
We both looked at each other and thought, well, we just buried this whale. Why don't we go dig it up?
It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll in 1910. She's really bending the mold of what's possible.
Doing the work that I did, it really seemed to me at the time that evil was in every single person.
She's in a windowless room that has a French drain that is backed up, filling up, and it's in the dark. She was in complete darkness.
I think when you feel in fear, loneliness disappears.
Is it too strong to call her like a mass murderer?
I call her a serial killer. There's no doubt about it.
Serial killers, whale hunters, kids in transition, criminals on the run, and people escaping cults. These are just some of the highlights from the year that is about to end. Just ahead, we'll meet the man who finds really big trees. We'll hear about neighbors that are trying to work things out. After that, we'll head to Tacoma to get a behind-the-scenes look at the close-knit community that serves us our drinks and meals. It's staff favorites today on Sound Effect. Stick around. One of the stories that triggered an emotional response in a lot of people this year is about a man who finds big trees. And Sound Effect producer Allie Ferguson did this piece, and the story originally aired in our Dream Big episode back in August. Allie, can you refresh us on this piece?
Yeah, so it was about this, a group of arborists who they look for the tallest trees of each species, and they keep track of these incredibly tall trees in a national registry. And so they'll go out into the forest to collect data on height and circumference and canopy length. And this involves, you know, special lasers and actually climbing the trees to figure out how tall they are.
And Kevin, I don't know if you remember this, but when Allie was getting ready to do this story, she was pretty
freaked out
about climbing a tree because she's really afraid of heights.
Yeah, I thought I was going to come back with just hours of tape of me crying in the middle of a tree, but I wanted to figure out why they do this.
You are connected. You are on belay.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I think so. I think I'm ready.
Okay.
That's arborist Mick Miazio. He's clipping me into a harness, and he's about to send me up into the tallest tree in Tacoma's Point Defiance Park. And I'm terrified. But I put my feet on the thick trunk of the tree, grab the orange rope, and begin to pull myself up.
Huh. It's a really big tree.
Only mildly terrifying.
Oh my god, they look so small.
At about 50 feet up in the air, I can see why Mick became an arborist. It's surreal to be up in the branches, like a squirrel or a bird. And that's exactly how Mick has always felt.
I remember climbing my first tree when I was a kid. I come from inner city, a lot of concrete, some trees, and there was this tree that's really not too big, but for a kid, it's a whole universe, right? As soon as I was able to, I jump right in there and I disappear, you know, I'm in my own world right there.
Mick loves trees, but this Jersey boy with Polish roots, he's more than just a worshiper of the forest. He's a missionary, a tree zealot. He wants everyone to love trees. And he's so intense, so earnest about it, sometimes it seems like he might actually convert the whole world. I am, of course, Mick's next convert, which is how we ended up in Point Defiance Park on a sunny Friday morning, hugging the trunk of a giant Douglas fir. Mick was the first to discover the park's tallest tree. He noticed it poking out of the canopy when he moved to Tacoma 3 years ago.
One day I went on Google Earth and took a virtual flight, and I flew up to what I thought was the tallest tree, took GPS coordinates, then I took some measurements, and eventually confirmed that the tree is 217 feet tall.
And what did you do when you first found this tree you'd been searching for on the internet?
When I first found this tree, when I arrived at the base, I fell to my knees. I just fell to my knees.
Why is that?
I was overwhelmed. I looked at it and it was beautiful. You know, I found myself in the presence of this live being that is probably as old or older than this nation. That's just powerful.
And what was it like when you climbed to the top?
That was also very powerful. You know, I made a decision a few years ago to devote my life to trees, I guess. And so it was like all that effort, dedication, sacrifice coming together in this one moment and place.
Can you describe what it looked like?
If you're at the base of it, depending on the time of the day, it's sort of dark. Right, because you have all these surrounding trees and plants and stuff. But once you ascend further up, you start being above everything else around you, and you can see the Cascades, you can see the Narrows Bridge, you can see Tacoma, you can see Mount Rainier, Mount Baker, Vashon. Yeah, the views are beautiful.
But Mick isn't just a solo adventurer. He's part of a national group of volunteer arborists and citizen scientists collecting data on tall trees. It's called the Big Tree Program. And the guy who tracks Washington State's big tree data is Mick's boss and mentor, Zeb Haney. Zeb says the program got started back in the 40s.
When folks across the United States would argue about whose tree was biggest, and it kind of became a state versus state kind of thing. And it still goes on like that. There's still rivalry amongst the states. But each state kind of runs it on its own through American forests. So many of these trees are just in places that we'll never find them unless somebody tells us, hey, we think we have a big tree. I found one. Just in the course of work, some folks had me out to look at their apple trees and pull up this long driveway. And I can see through the carport a very large maple tree. And it turns out I think it's the third largest big leaf maple in the world. And it's just in their backyard. They had no idea.
Why is it important to know where the big trees are?
They're living history. They've been in that spot for a long time before people lived there. And you can see it in the way that they grow, the way the branches are formed, broken, and regrow, and the hollows underneath that critters have lived in and that kids have played in.
Mick also loves that giant trees reflect the passing of time, and that these old-growth forests are home to endangered species like the marbled murrelet. And he likes contributing to the scientific effort to make up for his own small impact on nature. But his ambition is deeply personal, too.
One thing that's always in the back of my head is my brother. And he was murdered a few years back. And he was a great guy, even though he had a rough life. And one of the things he had was a great connection with nature. Like birds would sit on his hands and things like that. And so after he passed away, first of all, I tried to be more like him. Because that's the time, right? But second of all, I did get an idea in my head that I would like to discover a tree and dedicate it to him. And so those are some reasons that you may call selfish, but I would like to share this with people so that they can be proud, they can be aware, they can care, protect. You know, kids nowadays have problems with attention span, and adults too. You come here and you don't have to be focused and strained. You can just be. And I hope that when people just are, that they're good and full of love. And even if there's things that made people hard in their lives, that softens up and dissolves.
And that gets to Mick's next big dream, which is actually kind of small. He wants to share the wonder of the forest with everyone through their memories of trees.
What trees did they climb when they were a kid? What tree, you know, memories they have as adults? What tree memories they have with their families? I think that would be pretty neat.
Mick says everyone has a memory about trees, and he hopes that by sharing those memories, strangers will connect and remember their love of nature. I got to see some of these connections firsthand. One of the best things about Mick's favorite tree in Point Defiance Park is that it's a Pokestop. Yes, you heard me right, a stop in the hit game Pokemon Go. And so while Mick and I were hanging out in the dim green light of the forest, chatting about the importance of trees, folks kept strolling by, looking for Pokemon. And you'd think this ardent nature lover would be annoyed by people walking through the forest on their phones. But nope, it's just another opportunity to talk to strangers about trees.
Excuse me, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Did you climb trees when you were a kid?
Did I climb? Yeah.
What trees?
Oh, there was a willow in the backyard, a couple of maples, and...
I'm pretty close.
Hold on a second. Excuse me, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Did you climb trees when you were a kid?
Of course, he climbs trees now.
That's awesome.
Have a great day.
After these little interactions, Mick sits back down smiling. He's thrilled his tree was at the center of these small human moments. But this tree has been witness to so many of Mick's dreams. He got married here, at the base of the tallest tree in Point Defiance Park. Mick says he's not a religious person, but he has faith. And being in nature, in the forest, it's like being in church. So Mick keeps searching for tall trees, chasing that sacred feeling, and hoping others will share his dream.
That story from producer Allie Ferguson.
Hey, Jennifer, when you were kind of introing this story, you said one of the stories that triggered an emotional response from listeners. I'm terrified of heights too. So like right in the beginning there, my initial response when you kind of have this little sigh right before you're about ready to go up, it kind of took me there and made me like really uneasy. So that was my initial emotional response. But also I didn't expect to hear the part about his brother and how part of this is a big tribute to his brother in one way.
Yeah, Mick is an incredibly just emotional guy. And it was really sweet. He brought out a cedar tree that day, just a little seedling. Mm. Someone in his family had passed away just the day before, and we planted the seedling together in honor of this person. And it was a really emotional, heartfelt moment. And you know, I didn't get it on tape, but it was a really lovely way to end this beautiful day out in the forest.
Thank you, Allie.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, joined today by producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson, because today we are rebroadcasting some of our favorite stories that we've put together over the last 12 months. This next story was part of our episode last May called In My Backyard, and it was kind of complicated to tell. It was about two houses in Seattle's South Park neighborhood. A community activist, Jeff Hayes, he's a drummer too. He's lived in South Park for years, and so has his next door neighbor, Vicky Blacktongue. And Jeff has issues with the physical state of Vicky's house. And Vicky, she's had a pretty tough life and knows that Jeff is frustrated. What I really liked about this story is that it goes beyond the black and white sort of usual painted borders of he's right and she's wrong. And we see more of the grays, more of the nuances. And we see both of these people as two humans. And they believe they're really trying to do the right thing. A lot is packed into a small place in South Park. It's kind of out of the way, tucked between State Route 509 and the Duwamish River. The people who live here love the small town feel. They catch up at Via Vadi, the neighborhood's only coffee shop. Good pizza, Mexican food, and beer from the local brewery are just steps away. But there's also a lot of crime.
The drugs.
I saw a lady getting beat up.
The gang activity. Don't make eye contact. Don't look at them.
A cop never showed up, and the guy was dragging her somewhere, and I never ended up seeing where they went.
The prostitution that just happens in cars on the street.
They broke into my garage by taking the boards off on the alley side.
Degenerate people just doing whatever they want. It's not neighborly.
That's Farah Clinch, Max Lambeau, and Joseph Murphy. Even though they've all been witnesses to and victims of crime, they all agree with their neighbor, Jeff Hayes, who truly believes that 99% of the people in South Park are wonderful. He loves this place.
It's one of the most ethnically diverse neighborhoods in the city, has more children per capita than probably most other neighborhoods in the city. If there's going to be a neighborhood in the city that is representative of what city leaders say they want Seattle to be, it is South Park.
Jeff is 55 years old. He's a retired captain with the Seattle Fire Department. His brother is a retired Washington State Patrol officer. His brother-in-law and his nephew are cops in Kennewick.
Police officers are near and dear to my heart and are an integral part of my family.
Jeff is the block captain of block captains. He's a big man with a shaved head and a soul patch. He has lived in the same wood frame craftsman house on South Cloverdale for 17 years with his wife. They raised their daughter in this home. Out in the garage is where Jeff keeps his Harley Davidson, a road king. Not only does he know which homes brew the trouble in South Park where the pimps, the drug dealers, and the gang members live, he reports what he sees to police. One of these homes is right next door.
It's always been a problem.
It's his neighbor's house, Victoria and Stephen Blacktongue and their five children. Blacktongue, it's an unusual name. Stephen was born and raised on the Blackfoot Indian Reservation in Montana. Since April 2014, Seattle police have visited their modest single-story home 23 times.
You know, I've got emails going back 2 years to appropriate officials complaining about the obvious criminal activities going on over there.
One incident a few months ago involved a group of teenagers from the house who started randomly attacking things outside with a pickaxe.
One of my fellow neighbors came out of her house running with a phone in her hand and said, "Jeff, you need to go around to the back alley. There's some kids back there with a pickaxe, and they've taken to our fence, and they've taken to our boat, and I'm afraid they're going to go after my husband."
911, what are you reporting?
My husband just went after some kids in our back alley, jumped over the fence. So I think they were beating on our fence. And the kids are out of control. It's no one
else. From the street, the Blacktongue house looks a little run down, but nothing out of the ordinary. However, when you go around the back in the alley, the small yard is packed with an incredible amount of garbage. An abandoned car, what looks like a busted washing machine, an RV that's seen better days, has a blue tarp over its roof. It's a giant mess that can only be made right with the help of a tow truck, a backhoe, and a dumpster. It's a stark contrast to Jeff's yard next door, which has a wooden fence free of graffiti and a neatly trimmed lawn. As we stand in the alley, a maroon sedan pulls up. With the car running, a man gets out. Jeff doesn't recognize him and goes inside the back door of the Blacktongue house.
And I don't know what that guy's doing. I've never seen that guy before. I've never seen that vehicle before. If I called 911 right now, they would say, "Well, what are you reporting?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm reporting suspicious activity." "Well, what makes it suspicious?" And they end up making you feel like a fool for even calling 911 when you know that there's something bad going on. And I've been doing this for years. That's what I live next to.
Jeff Hayes has made many attempts to try and change the situation next door, to somehow make a dent in the chaos.
I have knocked on the door several times and spoken to Mr. Blacktongue, and was told that a lot of the people that are using his house for fencing stolen property and buying drugs are not people that he knows, and he has no control over it. I said, "Well, why don't you call the police?" And he said, "Because I'm a convicted felon and I just don't talk to police anymore." When I would go around to the back and actually confront the people in back, I would be threatened with violence. My house would be threatened with fire. They would threaten my family.
Jeff has called the police dozens of times. He sent multiple emails to Seattle's Department of Construction and Inspections about the garbage. He's called the State Department of Social and Health Services to report that he can see the teenagers next door drinking alcohol and getting high. Jeff says the state told him there isn't enough evidence to open a case looking into the welfare of the kids. The city's Department of Construction and Inspections has been out to take a look at the property and is now fining the home's owner, Victoria Blacktongue, for the conditions outside. So far, she owes more than $1,000.
I can't pay that. Sure, I'll give you guys that money and tell the mortgage company, sorry, I don't know what to do.
The day I knock on Victoria's door, or Vicky, as she likes to be called, there's a piece of paper taped to the front. In red marker are these words: stay away. You know who you are. Don't ever come back. Vicky is tired. She's missing some teeth. She's dealt with depression most of her life and is on disability. She quit using heroin years ago and goes to a methadone clinic twice a week.
I haven't given them a dirty UA since 2007.
UA is a...
Urine analysis where they screen us for drugs in our system.
Vicky knows what people are saying about her property and what goes on here.
I'm doing my best. I don't know if they could see it or they can tell.
The room we're in, the living room, is really clean. The bare wood floors are still drying after being mopped, and there's a faint smell of bleach in the air. There's a couch, a few pictures of the kids when they were small, not much else. The house was built by her grandfather in the 1960s and passed down to Vicky by her mother. To understand how things got to where they are today, you have to go back several years to when Stephen Blacktongue, her husband, got out of jail for attempted murder. When his parole ended, Vicky says old habits returned and he started doing hard drugs again. Then there was a fire at the house, so they brought in the RV to live in while the place was being fixed up. All the while, Vicky says the kids were growing up watching their dad shoot up, getting high, and stealing stuff. They eventually got out of hand, too.
You know, the last couple of years, they were bringing other kids, unruly kids, would come over here. This is the place to be unruly. No. I didn't know what to do. I was trapped. I was overwhelmed. My kids were off the hook. My husband was off the hook. I couldn't get my husband to help me with the kids because he was worse than they were. I wanted to sneak out the window and run and hide, and nobody would find me ever again.
In December, Vicky says her husband got hooked on meth.
The lovely drug that it is drives him nuts. I didn't want him anywhere near me. I could tell. I know him. I've known him for how long now? And the way he's talking to me, his touch, everything, I didn't like it. I knew he was on that drug. I mean, he just kept getting worse and worse, and then, yeah, March 13th happened. That was horrible.
March 13th was the day Stephen Blacktongue walked into a 7-Eleven armed with an axe.
This is Q13 Fox News at 10.
A convenience store customer stopped a man who went on a violent hatchet rampage this morning by pulling out a pistol and shooting
It was
him.
Sunday, early in the morning. Stephen walked into a 7-Eleven near Burien carrying an axe. He started attacking the man behind the counter. He left a gash on the clerk's belly, but before he could cause any more harm, another customer with a legal concealed gun shot Blacktongue, killing him. Vicky doesn't know exactly why her husband did this. She suspects it was the meth that made him lose his mind. Vicky is trying to piece together a life that does not involve drugs, robberies, gangs, vandalism, or visits from the police. She's trying to keep the kids and their friends who want to use the place to store stolen property away from the house. There's a man living in the RV out back she doesn't really know. Even though he's pretty quiet, she still wants him out. She says hauling the RV away would cost $500.
I don't have that. I'm kind of stuck right now.
And then there's the problem with the condition of the house itself. Tara Salazar, Vicky's longtime friend, says the place doesn't have any running water. Tara says Stephen Blacktongue's drug addict friends went under the house and took all of the pipes.
They came and stole her copper plumbing, but then after they put the plumbing in, they crawled under their house and stole it again.
There's no plumbing.
So you're home. You can't use the bathroom.
We lined the toilets with garbage bags, and my son takes the garbage out.
Vicky says the city stopped collecting the trash months ago. So for now, garbage bags filled with human waste are stored in the backyard. She says police have told her that where the pipes used to be in the crawl space, this is where suspects on the run in the neighborhood sometimes hide out. Even though Vicky wants to turn things around and make things right with people like her neighbor, Jeff Hayes, the criminal element of South Park might refuse to let go of this house. Meanwhile, Jeff has complained to the right people, the right agencies. Now all he can do is wait for something to happen. It could take a while, and he's really frustrated.
It feels like as a citizen, I'm in a cage and the police department puts me on the hamster wheel to run in a circle because they don't want to have to deal with me outside of the cage and have to really deal with it, the issues that are confronting this neighborhood.
We've been dealing with Mr. Hayes and the Black Tongue House for quite some time.
This is Pierre Davis. He's the captain of Seattle's Southwest Police Precinct, which includes South Park. He says police can't do anything without building a case. The Black Tongues have rights just like everyone else.
If you're going to do something narcotics-wise, because that seems to be the crux of a lot of the issues down there, there's probable cause that has to be developed. And we just can't build this stuff out of thin air. There has to be a certain amount of workup that's associated with that. We can't flood the area and kick people out of their houses or arrest them for no reason. There has to be something there for us to go forward.
So what about the physical state of the Black Tongue property, the garbage, the RV, the trash bags of sewage? Is there anything the city can do about that? Brendan Brophy, an assistant city attorney for Seattle, says if Vicky doesn't clean up her yard, fines will continue to stack up. The courts could get involved and force Vicky to let the city help out. But this work can cost thousands of dollars, all billed to the owner. And the lack of plumbing in the house? No laws are being broken there.
If you want to set up a tent in your living room and live that way, it's your property. You can do that.
At this point, you're probably wondering, why doesn't Jeff Hayes move?
I guess I'm a glutton for punishment. The worse it gets, the more I refuse to leave, because I'm not going to leave until it gets better.
And are you willing to die for this?
No. I'm not willing to die for it. I try to balance that line between doing something and not putting my personal safety at risk.
Vicky doesn't want anyone else to get hurt either. She doesn't want anyone else to die. And while she has talked about selling her house, she really doesn't want to move away from the neighborhood her family has called home since the 1940s. She wants to do right by her neighbors. She wants the same thing that Jeff wants. No crime, no drama. But as she said earlier, she's a little stuck right now.
So, Jennifer, what happened to Vicky's house?
Well, Vicky's backyard, it did get cleaned up in September, and the broken down RV, that's gone. The bags of sewage, they were taken away, and the city did put a lien on the property for the cost of the cleanup, because the city actually did come in and do all this work, and the cost is $1,680, and city officials say that they'll probably have to go back in and do another cleanup, and will place yet another lien on the house. And I tried to contact Vicky to see if she did get plumbing installed in her home, but I haven't been able to reach her.
I would say one of the things that really jumped out to me in this story that is kind of like burned in my brain is that sign on the front door that said, "Stay away, you know who you are, don't ever come back." Mm-hmm. That's just kind of chilling, and it's kind of just sets up all this trouble that we're going to hear about. It's kind of like this foreshadowing, right? you know, and the fact that, you know, I remember hearing on the news about that March 13th date at 7-Eleven, and that was like 10 minutes away from where I grew up. And this story really just kind of took me into the South Park neighborhood and inside this house. That's one of the things I really like about it.
Yeah. And this is a situation that maybe a lot of people might find themselves in. And, you know, that's what I love about this show, is that we have the time and space to tell stories like this.
Yeah, we've probably been in a position before where we've had that neighbor from hell, or we kind of just label them as a neighbor from hell.
Or maybe we were the neighbor from hell.
Yeah, maybe we were the neighbor from hell, but this really humanized a couple people here.
I remember I used to drive my neighbors crazy by vacuuming at like 7:30 in the morning when I was living in Bellingham, and they would leave notes on my door.
If that's the worst thing you've ever done, yeah, I think, yeah. Especially after this story, I think you're probably in good shape.
Yeah, yeah. This is Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing with producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson joining me in the studio today, giving a listen to some of our favorite stories from 2016. And our last story comes from Kevin, and he did it back in September for our show called The Ties That Bind. So Kevin, you moonlighted as a lot of things outside of your radio career over the last 15 years.
Yeah, so I crunched numbers on a construction site. I helped run a 5-star medical spa with the lasers and everything like that. I worked for a screen printing company. I made t-shirts. I worked at Nordstrom. I coached tennis. But it was kind of this really eye-opening experience for me almost immediately when I started bartending in Tacoma. And it's just how well everyone knew each other and how it was like this one really big family, which was odd and might almost seem impossible for a city that's as big as Tacoma, right? And this isn't just bars that are like next door to each other. These are people across town that are really tight-knit and know each other. And the time I spent doing this, I was immediately sucked into this sort of family life and found it very, very unique to Tacoma. And you don't really think that pouring drinks for other people might warrant this kind of environment, but it did. Test, test, test. Hello.
Hi, babe.
Why do you call me babe?
Years ago, we were at Patty Coins downtown in Tacoma. I was the general manager there and lead bartender at night. And you were working at Nordstrom and NPR, and you would come in after work and have a couple drinks and visit me.
Okay, so this is Rose Peterson. She's the general manager now at 1022 South J, a craft cocktail bar and restaurant in Tacoma, and is one of my dearest friends. I tracked her down at her house on a Monday afternoon, a day most bartenders have off.
I was dating this boy that would constantly text me, babe, with exclamation marks, if I hadn't responded quickly enough. And you saw that and thought it was hilarious and started calling me babe. And I immediately started calling you babe right back, and it stuck.
And then you started working at a different bar.
Yes, I went from there to DOA on 6th Avenue.
And then you hired me.
Yes, I hired you to bartend with me there.
And then most of Tacoma ended up knowing me as Babe. How did that happen?
Well, it started probably with just them overhearing it, but then I eventually changed your name on your receipts to Babe, so it would say you have been served by Babe.
My name is Jamie K. Jones, and I currently own the Top of Tacoma and another food service restaurant by the name of Built.
How long have you been in the bar industry?
Since it was legal. I got my first hostess job at the age of 15.
My name is Richard Sumner, and I work at O'Malley's Irish Pub on 6th Avenue in Tacoma. Started bartending, I believe, in 2002, 2003. So, 13, 14 years.
I think that for a normal person, if you tell them that you wake up at 11 or 12 o'clock in the morning or early afternoon, that they think that that's a little strange, but if you consider that when you get home, if you're working a 9-to-5 job and you get home at 5:30, you don't go to sleep at 7 p.m., you know? So it's the same when you're bartending. If you get off at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, I don't go to sleep until maybe 5 o'clock in the morning, and which makes that 11 o'clock wake-up time fairly normal for me.
Well, you hope to fall asleep by 5 in the morning if you worked a closing shift, but just like anything, you know, usually your customers come in after work at 4:35 p.m. to unwind from their day. As a bartender, where are you going to unwind from your shift, you know, when you get out of there at 4 in the morning? There's really not much place to unwind besides with your coworkers, which really, I think, helps develop the strong family relationships you have with who you work your shifts with and, you know, do your unwind time with. Food's different, sleep's different, you know, real life appointments are different.
There's a couple of bonuses and a couple of drawbacks to it. One of the bonuses is that my weekends usually are on weekdays. So when I'm not working, I have the ability to go out and take care of a lot of projects and errands. The downside of it is I do work nights, I work weekend nights, and the majority of my friends are all responsible adults, and they have Monday through Friday jobs, so I don't really get to hang out with a lot of my friends very often. So my social life is the bar.
So there is a lifestyle for bartenders, and then there is the life for bartenders in Tacoma.
It's a big little town. I don't know if I would call us a city. We're almost a city. It's very real. It's a blue-collar city, which I think makes everyone a little bit more real than a larger city.
It's a melting pot type of place. It doesn't matter what you look like. You could be a businessman, a punk rocker, or just a blue-collar worker and find somebody to talk to and hang out. The bar industry in Tacoma is very tight-knit. You can't really, if you're a bartender and you're a good bartender and you've done this for a while, you can't really go anywhere without some kind of recognition. Hell, I even know a couple of really crappy bartenders that get recognition.
You get to a point in your career in bars in Tacoma where everyone knows you. I mean, most of the people that walk through the door in my bar say hi, Rose, on their way in. And I think that that's part of the allure of it, is that you have all of these acquaintances. And if you went to a different town, you wouldn't see any familiar faces. And I think that would take a lot of the fun out of it.
So there's a name that makes its way into conversation when talking about the Tacoma bar industry. And as I heard his name more and more, it became clear that this was someone who was a standout in this crowd. And even though he's no longer here, his stories remain.
Can you tell me who Brian Redmond is?
Brian Redmond was one of the best bartenders that I have ever had the pleasure of working with or knowing. Delightful bastard. He was... Very rarely was he overly serious. He was always a good time.
He worked at Doyle's, got into an accident on a scooter, and hit a telephone pole and was killed several years ago.
He's just a special individual with a super bright shine, and he loved people, and he made an impact no matter what he did.
He affected so many people in working with them, serving them, playing music for them. Ultimately, he was a Tacoma icon. He was a dead-to-rights rock star.
There are still, you know, pictures of him everywhere. There are still lighters that float around that say "Rock in Peace, Brian." You know, there's a bandana like one he used to wear on the telephone pole where he was killed.
He had a good time. He honored himself, and he was an individual, and ironically, probably didn't give a shit what anybody thought, but everybody thought he was cool.
And because of how fun and approachable he was, he created and generated a lot of really good friends from first-time bar visitors or long-time co-workers.
In a town like this, if someone's passed away, everyone kind of rallies together and ends up in the same place, you know, having a conversation about that person. it's comforting to know that no one has an answer at that point and everyone's kind of figuring things out together.
It's fairly funny that in a roundabout way, I know you because of him. I was working at the waterfront RAM, and a couple of my coworkers and friends were like, hey, let's go out after work. Well, let's go check out this place, Doyle's. I'm like, what the hell is that? Well, an Irish pub. I'm like, eh, what the hell? They got whiskey. Let's go. So we go in there, and my friend Brian is behind the bar. And back when I first met him, he had a nickname, Bacon Grease, because he freaking loved bacon. Like, I swear, the guy would bathe in it if he could. But walk in the door, yell Bacon Grease, and he's like, what's up? We had this like no handshake where you slap your hands together like you're doing a five, but you keep your hands together, but you wouldn't roll your fingers over, and you just shake your hand up and down. He was fun, weird. My soon-to-be girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, was working with him, a very attractive, short, blonde woman named Leah, another Tacoma bartending icon. And you know, flirted around with her, got to know her over years, and dated her for a good number of years. And she worked with you at DOA. And I would come in to visit her, and I got to meet you and talk to you. And it's that 6 degrees of separation. He's Brian was our Kevin Bacon, Kevin Bacon Grease, if you will. And I because of those interactions, I've met really, really great people that I'm very honored to know.
Tacoma won't let you forget anything that you've done, whether it's positive or negative. And if you do good business and you treat your community with respect, you will be supported. And if you do bad business and you treat your community with disrespect, it will definitely reflect on your business.
It doesn't matter what bar you work in, we all look at each other like a family. Maybe every once in a while you got that one jerk bartender, well, that's our cousin. And then you got the one superstar that everybody loves and everybody knows. And just find a common ground through service and then find out we have a lot more in common.
Talking to other people in the Tacoma bar and restaurant industry, you learn pretty quickly that many of them found their spouse or partner through work, and that many of them wouldn't or couldn't pour a drink outside of the city of Tacoma.
Maybe it's because Tacoma's a drinking city. We all spent a lot of time with each other in bars when we were younger, and then eventually got jobs in the bars that we were hanging out in. And once you're in the industry in this city, it kind of feels like you just stay there.
I love you, babe.
I love you too, babe.
Thank you.
Kevin, I remember one of the first times we really hung out was down in Tacoma for a staff meeting, and you said, hey, you want to grab a drink afterwards? And we basically just drove around Tacoma, and you were like, I worked at that bar and that bar, and my friend is at that bar and that bar. And I was so excited to hear the story because it really captured this, you know, this part of you that's this is really sweet.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, another softer side.
Yeah.
When I first heard this story, you painted such a great picture and took us into this world that a lot of us never get to go into. And I thought, how did you leave this family? How did you leave this community of people? Because you all cared deeply about one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that caring didn't really stop when the job stopped. That was one thing. And I think one really good example of that is I went and hosted a morning show over in North Carolina for a year. And while I was over there, my grandfather passed away, and I was really, really close to him. And I used to brag to my customers and to other bartenders in Tacoma that I can make the best Manhattan in town and that I learned the recipe from my grandfather. So the night that my grandfather passed, I sent a few texts out to some friends back home in Tacoma. And I woke up the next morning, and my phone was flooded with pictures of bartenders and old customers around Tacoma holding up a Manhattan in honor of my grandfather. And, you know, I think that's a, sorry, I think that's just, you know, an environment that you don't find everywhere.
No.
Wow.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
And I will share the recipe.
Yes.
On our website, soundeffect.org.
I think we could use one of those right now.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin.
You bet.
As producers Ali Ferguson and Kevin Kniestad and I wrap up the year by sharing our favorite sound effect stories from 2016, we can't close out the show without mentioning a story that affected the entire radio station and you out there, the listener. It was a little over a year ago that we got some news here at 88.5 that the station was being sold and that we would all be out of a job. And this is what things sounded like back then.
It was a blow to me because I think that this is a special culture that has been built up over many, many, many decades. And it just kills me that that's being swept away.
The people that I've worked with are like my family, and so that felt like a loss.
I mourn not the loss of a job, but just the culture.
Just thinking about things like not being able to talk to Art Teal every week. And not about sports, but just as a person.
There's a little pain that we didn't have before. That's an incredibly hard thing to picture, is turning out the lights here.
But then we were given the chance to try and save ourselves and become a community licensed radio station. Again, thanks to you, the listener, this was the big news just a few months after we started the campaign to raise more than $7 million.
Donors have saved radio station KPLU, raising $7 million to stop the sale of 88.5.
The station's general manager couldn't contain his excitement as he made the announcement to listeners.
Very excited to announce today that we reached our goal of $7 million.
Yeah, it's been a pretty amazing year, you guys. Can't believe we did that.
I mean, it seems like yesterday. I mean, I know you were here, Jennifer, at the time. You and I have both been here a really long time, and I think we kind of just maybe like thought KPLU will always be here. And so we get this news, and I remember us all posing for this picture in these KPLU sweatshirts that were handed out.
That was a day that seemed like it lasted 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. We uncorked a couple bottles of wine. And then Allie, you know, it's like you came on kind of in blind faith. You know, you joined the show when we were going through this whole, are we going to be able to do it or not thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Sound Effect, it had an impact on me. Mm. And I knew I wanted to work with you guys and work with the show, even if it was just 4 months. I knew I was going to be able to be a part of something special. And I also, you know, talking to people here when I started, I just had faith. You had so much support from the community that I never really thought you wouldn't make it, or we wouldn't make it. Then it became we. So it's one of the better risks I've taken in my life.
We are glad that you took it.
Yes, we are. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, cheers to the new KNKX, right?
Yes.
And to another year next year.
Yes, yeah. Another year. Yeah, another year of stories. Great storytelling here on Sound Effect. Well, that is it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson. And we get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you'd like to share a story, you can send an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next year with Change of Scenery.
I simply put on a record and tried to play with it. And I couldn't get through 12 bars.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.